This is Shanna Ederer. Today is November 4, 2016. I am a student at UW-Madison. I am interviewing Jan Thompson. This interview is taking place at the 2016 Society of American Foresters National Convention in Madison, Wisconsin, at the Monona Terrace Convention Center. This interview is sponsored by the Society of American Foresters and the University of Wisconsin Oral History Program, and is part of the SAF Oral History Project. Could you please say your name and spell your last name?
I'm Jan Thompson, Thompson.
To start off, could you tell me the story of how you came to be a forester?
Yes. I grew up in central lower Michigan, and my parents liked to travel and liked to visit state parks and national parks, and so I grew up with a lot of experiences that were wonderful experiences in the natural world. They also built a new home when I was about 5 in an abandoned agricultural area in central lower Michigan. And so it was, in retrospect, me playing in areas that were undergoing succession while I was growing up. It's kind of weird to think about now, but just a delightful opportunity to explore the natural world with, you know, my little buddies who lived nearby, and went off to college. And at first I thought I would major in biology, and I went to the biology 110 class, and they were showing us slides of people in white coats standing next to black lab benches. And fortunately for me, the school I'd chosen to go to was Michigan Tech, and so it was a relatively short hike from main campus up the hill to the forestry department there. And I think after the second week of classes, I never looked back. So.
Could you tell me a little bit about your career as a forester?
So I'm a career academic. I joke with my friends that I'm in 52nd grade. So I earned a bachelor's degree in forestry at Michigan Tech in 1981. I went from there to Iowa State University to pursue a master's degree in soil science. And that was in the agronomy department there. And I finished that master's degree, but really was missing the more dynamic and fun and growing stuff that I dealt with as an undergraduate. So, and again, it was an easy hike across the street to the forestry department at Iowa State, and I took a course just to see, do I still know anything about forestry, and really enjoyed the faculty and the other students, and so I took an appointment to work on a PhD in forestry. I'm still at Iowa State. I've had a variety of job titles. Now I'm a named professor there, but it took a long time to get there.
Could you tell me a little bit about some of the work that you've done in your academic career at Iowa?
Yeah, so when I first went there to work on my master's degree, I was very interested at the time in how soils influence tree growth. And I really thought that I would be in Iowa for 2 years, maybe 3. And that was a long time ago, like more than 30 years ago. And I enjoyed the soil science, but coming back to forestry gave me the opportunity. I guess I thought what I would do with a master's degree was do research and development for a company like Weyerhaeuser or somebody that was trying to grow trees in a kind of an intensive regime where soils would be really important in terms of how the trees grew. But then I decided that really I was more interested in the trees than the soils per se. So the work I did for my dissertation research was looking at how seedlings grown in nurseries become established and what characteristics of seedlings lead to better establishment after outplanting. And I was working on my dissertation when the first round of CRP was in the Farm Bill, so there was a lot of interest in people planting large numbers of seedlings in relatively large areas in most of the Midwestern states. And so my assistantship project was working with a consortium of state nurseries in the Midwest, looking at how they cultured seedlings and then how well those seedlings performed when they were outplanted. And my own research within that was looking at root system morphology, primarily of oak species that we grow more in Iowa than in some of the other states. So I was looking at what are the characteristics of the root systems of seedlings that when they're planted out, they're more successful. So it was an opportunity to use what I knew from my forestry background and what I had, basically we're outplanting these on different kinds of sites with different kinds of soils. So I was still looking at the influence of soils on tree growth, but it just wasn't in the same context that I had originally envisioned. And it was great because we had the opportunity to travel and work with people in Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Missouri, Iowa. And for most of the time, it was most of those states. A couple of the states were 1 or 2 years out of, I think the whole project was 5 years. So.
Great. So how have you been involved with the Society of American Foresters?
So I had attended a few conventions, I think, and given a couple of papers and posters as a graduate student. And then I wasn't real involved for a while. When I became a faculty member, then I officially joined the SAF. And again, I attended on a regular basis for a number of years, and then I was doing different things at different times. So I'm also I teach urban forestry and I do research in urban ecology now. And so I kind of alternated for a few years between ISA conferences and SAF conferences. They're both, unfortunately, not well-timed in terms of my academic duties. So I alternated years because the ISA meets in August before classes start, and SAF has always been later in the fall, and I can't always be here.
And just to remind our listeners, so ISA stands for?
The International Society of Arboriculture. Okay. And I'm a member of that organization. I probably at this point attend their meeting less than I attend this one. Over time, I've been more or less involved with the voluntary structure of the Society of American Foresters. So I've participated as the chair of the Urban Forestry Working Group, well, secretary, chair-elect, and chair. So I think that was like a 6-year period of time where I was involved as an officer for the B2 Working Group. And then I've also been, right now I'm in the middle or toward the end of a 3-year term as the B subject area rep to the Forest Science and Technology Board. So during years when I've had an officer role, I always come to this meeting and do the affiliate meetings during the pre-meeting part. Mm-hmm. And then I usually stick around for
so I think
part
you
of
said
the digital convention.
B subject rep?
Yeah, the B subject area rep.
Could you tell us a little bit about...
So the B subject areas include urban forestry, agroforestry, international forestry, and family forestry. And so they're the kind of the forest management-oriented working groups. And I serve as kind of a liaison between what's now called the council, which feeds stuff down to the Forest Science and Technology Board, and then that board has regional reps as well as representatives of the different working groups that take information and send it out to the folks in the working groups and receive back information from them.
Great. This project was developed to understand people's perceptions of diversity and inclusion in the forestry profession. How has your ethnicity or culture background or maybe gender influenced your career as a forester?
Ha. I'm not sure how to answer that question. When I was an undergraduate in forestry, I think the class I was in was the first forestry class at Tech that was 50-50. And the main campus was very different from that. I think it was more like 85-15. So Michigan School of Mines, it was very much an engineering school. And that, being on, if I was on the main campus, that was just plain intimidating. But up in the forestry building, we were getting a little bit closer to, you know, what looked like a pretty healthy mix of from a gender perspective. And I never really felt as an undergraduate student like there was any difference among the students. I think looking back, all of my professors were men, but I don't feel like that bothered me in any way. It just was the way it was. We had some women who were graduate research assistants that served sometimes as teaching assistants, so there was some contact with people and somewhat of a position of authority, especially over undergrads, right? And then when I went to Iowa State in the agronomy department, I think among the graduate students, again, there was a pretty healthy balance, but on the faculty, they still don't have anything even remotely approaching a balance between men and women on that faculty. And so I started to kind of notice a little bit more what, you know, something seemed to be happening in terms of the trajectories of women in the discipline. When I returned to forestry, it felt a lot more egalitarian, although again, I think the faculty was predominantly male. But I didn't really perceive that there would ever be an issue with respect to that. As a graduate student, I always felt as though I was treated as a colleague and on very much an equal footing with men and women. And our department at the time also had a lot of cultural diversity. We had a lot of international students. I think some of those students might have had more surprise at the balance among the students coming from some cultures where that was unusual. But I think I started kind of picking up that this can have an impact on your career, probably as a postdoc and certainly as an early career faculty member. And although I never felt as though there were any outright instances of you know, discrimination or, you know, I never felt like I was being harassed in any way at all, I started noticing that there were things that I wasn't being asked to do, maybe. And so in that way, being treated a little bit differently, and maybe there were different opportunities because of that. After I was promoted to associate professor, a few years later, I had the opportunity to work with Iowa State University team that received an institutional transformation grant from the NSF that was focused specifically on creating a better, well, focused on understanding what are the things in the academic environment that might discourage women in the sciences and how to work with faculty members primarily and to a certain extent also administrators to examine what were kind of the specific workplace, culture, climate. It's kind of hard to describe, but you know, what are the kind of the unspoken codes of the workplace that might influence the career trajectories, and how career trajectories are actually strategically built. I myself wasn't particularly strategic. I was always doing what I enjoyed doing, and had never really sat down to say, you know, by this point in my career, I should be, you know, at X, and later on, I should be at Y. So for me, being part of that ISU Advanced project was really eye-opening in terms of what could the cumulative effects of that kind of gender differential be over the course of a person's career. And I began to be a little more militant when I saw things that I didn't think were, you know, were correct.
So were there perhaps some changes that grew out of that work with the institutional transformation grant?
Yeah, I think people in general became much more aware of the consequences and the long-term consequences of a number of small, what seemed like small, things like the notion of who you invite for an interview and how you balance a class of people that you invite to interview for a position, or how you evaluate people's documents for promotion and tenure, or how you go about setting up a roster for a seminar series. How to really be always conscious of the importance of balance in those things. And I think, you know, I worked on coaching people on overcoming implicit bias. I worked with people on overcoming things like, you know, making quick choices or quick judgments. And so, you know, that the tendency would be that your cognitive availability would govern your, you know, what you first thought of. If I'm going to invite somebody to come give a named lecture, for example, and I think of somebody right away, that's because they were cognitively available to me, right? But if I stop and think about it longer, I might think about maybe a group of six people and then evaluate and think about, okay, if last year it was a man, maybe this year it should be a woman, or, you know, so that there was going to be a greater likelihood that these things wouldn't add up over time to always inviting men. For example, my department has a named lecture, and it's been going on, I think, for 66 years, and during that time, there have been 61 men and 4 women invited to give this name talk. Well, you know, that adds up for the men particularly well. So those kinds of things, and it's not on purpose. It's not that people are purposefully being discriminatory. It's that they aren't, that these are unconscious choices that are made at an unconscious level without stopping to think about what the impact might be. So people find me a real problem if I'm on their seminar selection committee.
What are your thoughts, in a more general sense, about diversity and inclusion in the forestry profession as a whole?
That it's gonna take a lot of work. I see that the conversation is happening, and that's a very good thing. And but we have to do a whole lot more than have the conversation. And so I've been making a little bit of noise for a few years now. I was regularly attending the SAF conference as the B2 working group officer. And the year that I went off of being chair at the convention, I believe this was before they started having kind of the awards celebration thing that there will be tonight, but the awards were presented, I think, in one segment in the plenary. And they were all men. They were all men. And I, you know, there might have been a little bit of diversity among the men, but I don't even remember that. And I was seated next to my then department chair, and I was just squirming. I just could not sit still. And when it was over, I got up and pretty much ran out of the room. And so I saw him later. He's like, "Everything okay?" And I'm like, "No, everything is decidedly not okay." And he wanted to know what the problem was. And so I told him in no uncertain terms what I thought the problem was. And, you know, I didn't come back to the SAF conference, partly because I'd given up my role as chair of a working group, but partly because I was steamed. So, you know, and I think the important thing is not that people are aware that we're talking about it, but that people become aware that we're serious about it. And when you start seeing things change, you know, and when the audience who's looking at those award winners sees someone that they think they could be in 20 years, that then things start to change, and then you get much more engagement. You know, if we have, you know, diversity broadly represented at every level, then people can see themselves, and they can see, and you know what it's going to be. Are you going to go to the ceremony tonight? There will be two women up there and about 30 men.
I will have to look forward to seeing what happens.
So I know there's one field forester. I think there's one fellow nominee and then the young professional this year. So three women, 30 men. We're just not... And last year, at least one of the men appeared to be... of an underrepresented group ethnically, but he was still a man, so not holding that against him. But so I think, you know, the Society of American Foresters is very interested in addressing this, but it has to be systemic. It has to be, and I since I am on the Forest Science and Technology Board, I believe last year I said, well, can we make any requirements that nominees nominate slates that are balanced? You know, for there are some groups that nominate a lot and there are other groups that we never hear from, but could we have a requirement that for every X you nominate, you also have to nominate a Y and a Z? And I'm kind of a radical, I guess, but that's what will even the playing field, is if you have created a structure that requires it. Because it doesn't seem to be happening on its own.
Do you have other ideas about the role that the Society of American Foresters could play in enhancing diversity and inclusion? Because it's clear you've done a lot of work and you think about this a lot.
Well, you know, I don't know, save, you know, I think I'm really encouraged that we have this diversity and inclusion track. I think that we just need to make it clear that this is everybody's business. It's not the business of a few people who are interested in it. It's for the good of the society as a whole. And I really think that that this diversity at all levels is really important, because what we tend to see, I think, in this society is there are a lot of young women who come as part of the groups of college students, and we have a fabulous number of college students here at this convention, and then by the time they're mid-career or past it, they're just not there. I look around the room. Well, this is a problem. This is not a problem only to SAF. So I have attended the affiliate meetings before the meeting, also representing my department among the group of chairs and deans. And I always sit down, and because of the years I spent in ISU Advance, I'm always counting how many suits and how many skirts I see. And the numbers were enough to make me chagrined for a day and a half. And I mean, that's a university thing. They're not even part of SAF, but they are, you know, they're having their affiliate meeting here. They're the leaders of the forestry programs. And so it's not, you know, it's a problem in the profession. It's not a problem for SAF any more than it's a problem in the profession.
Where do you see the profession of forestry going in the next 20 years?
I think, because they've started this conversation, that, and I see a lot more diversity now than I did 20 years ago when I first joined SAF. I think there is this interest in thinking about the future, and I believe that that interest, combined with this growing awareness that our demographics don't represent what they could as a society, I believe that it's going to become more diverse at every level and more inviting for people to participate. And I think that the you know, a lot of things are changing at once. We have very new and different ways of doing science. We have, I think, a better handle on how to make our science useful to the people who need to apply it. And I see that these ways of kind of integrating work across not just what kind of work we do, but who we do that work with, and that people never realized they needed to be intentional about all of these things. And I believe that now that these conversations are happening, that people realize, oh, that is a result of choices, and we need to start being a lot more intentional about the choices and making sure that those choices are inclusive, you know, of people as well as of disciplines and as well as of, you know, people who are doing very basic research and people doing very applied research and people who are actually trying to use that research to create a better, you know, result on the ground, and that we're all going to have to work across that so much more than we did before.
How about the next 100 years?
Oh, my God.
Thinking a little ways out.
100 years. So where does that take us to? Wow. That's way out there. Next 100 years. Yeah. So the futuring guys. We need the futuring guys. But that was also very interesting last year. One of the plenary speakers was the new head of the Strategic Foresight Group in the Forest Service Station in Minnesota, David Bengston. And I feel like there's also a couple of futuring tracks, and Mike is in that Strategic Foresight Group, Mike Dockery, who you mentioned earlier. So I think that probably instead of being dragged along into the future, that people are also going to embrace this, let's think about the future more, let's think about it more purposefully and intentionally, instead of, you know, all of a sudden we're here, right? and then choosing what do we want that future to be, and making, again, more intentional choices about how to move from where we are now to where we are then, right? So not that we won't make mistakes, but I think if we listen to those people who are really focusing on looking to the future, that we have a better chance of remaining relevant, useful, solving some of the challenges that art that seemed to be solvable if only we would do what needs to be done. I don't know, like, it doesn't undo bizarre political forces or, or, you know, I mean, so that's, it's interesting to think about, but I believe that people are moving in the direction of being more future oriented.
I think we've touched on some of these issues already, but do you have anything else to add about how the profession of forestry has changed during the course of your career?
I guess with the exception of technology, which I feel like has changed in spurts, like certain things come along and move us a great distance, like using GIS. All of a sudden, boom, you know, we have all this spatial information. And so I feel like the science has moved us in these spurts, whereas socially, it's been very gradual, incrementally becoming, I think, more open to new ideas and less. I mean, there are still scientific debates, but I feel like there are fewer that are acrimonious. Like, we've learned how to listen to each other better, and we've learned how to try to, if not embrace different ideas, at least attempt to understand other ideas, even if they're more or less, you know, if they could be viewed it as being opposite our own, that there's a greater tendency to want to learn from each other. But that's been very gradual. But I don't see, like, you know, the great debates of that we heard about when we were hearing about history, like Hetch Hetchy. I don't feel like there's this much, you know. I feel like we are more of a united group now, and that our challenges are probably on a grander scale, like climate change, right? It's not about a single reservoir where you're gonna, you know, you're gonna change one valley. No, we're changing the whole globe and the dynamics and where things grow and how long they grow each year, and that's like bigger somehow than the kinds of issues that people dealt with.
What has been the most rewarding aspects of your career?
Well, so I think for me, I've been, for most of my career, with a couple of very brief exceptions, in academia. And so I have both the privilege and the responsibility of working with people who are just learning about forestry, and I really like working with students. I really like watching them as they develop as learners and as professionals, and watching that happen, even though most of them are with us for just 4 or 5 years, there's a big change that takes place. And I really, really like working with seniors, because they're there. They're, you know, they just change so much during those 4 years, and I really like working with them. I like them learning about forestry. I like them learning about natural resource management, and I like them developing as professionals. And Iowa State has 15 students who are here at this conference, and I'm not their advisor, I'm not their club advisor, so this is probably like the best of both worlds, to be occasionally checking in on them, and when I see them all together, visiting with them. But this, the way this conference really opens their eyes to the profession, is really fun to watch. It's very fun to watch. So I like working with students. I also like doing research. And so I think the thing is that I like learning, and I'm trying to always be open to learning. And, you know, I think at some point a lot of people in their lives and careers kind of start shutting down maybe on the learning thing. But and it takes time, it takes energy, it takes enthusiasm, it takes, you know, wanting to be challenged, you know. And it's not on every single day I want to be challenged, but I don't want to lose that fascination with new ideas and new information.
What have been some of the biggest challenges in your career?
Well, you know, academia can be stressful. And I think a lot of that is self-imposed by academics in some ways, although, you know, there are strong expectations, and that's good. A person would want there to be strong expectations, but I don't feel like there have been big barriers. But I also feel like if I were to do it all over again, I would be very much more strategic. So maybe a barrier of mine was just me not realizing how important it would be to be strategic.
So give me an example of maybe a way in which one could be sort of a strategic career thinker.
I guess developing a pretty detailed plan of, you know, start with the end in mind. Where do I want to be in 20 years? And then work your way back. How do I get there? I was always engaged in the present moment. I want to work with these students. I want to do, you know, research in this area. And instead of having worked back from where I want to be, you know, having a goal, a realistic, but I never did that. So it was like, it was more like it was just a, I mean, it wasn't just a job, but it wasn't like I planned to ever be a full professor, or I ever planned to be, you know. So if I were going to be more strategic, I would say, you know, by 2020, I want to be this thing, whatever it is. And that just wasn't the way I operated. I was more like, oh, that's a cool idea. Let's go, you know, do that for a while. So.
What advice would you give a student or a new forester just starting off?
To figure out how they best learn, and to just keep learning. We have, I don't know, I think for our department, I'm the person that does our outcomes assessment, and we have an outcome called lifelong learning. And we try to measure kind of amongst our students their proclivity toward lifelong learning, being curious, you know, showing awe and wonder at something that seems fabulous and fantastic, right? And saying if they don't know something, they're going to go try to find out what it is they don't know and what tools can they use to do those things. And so that would be my advice, is know how you best learn and go for it.
So to finish up, we have a few basic demographic questions. The first is, what year were you born?
1960.
And what gender do you identify as?
I identify as female.
And what is your ethnic, racial, or cultural background?
Euro-American, Caucasian.
Would you like to add anything about forestry, Society of American Foresters, or diversity that we did not cover?
I really like the Society of American Foresters. I have enjoyed being a part of the society, and I think it's a strong community. I do hope that we continue to learn and grow together, and that as we start to make some more intentional choices about everything that we do as a society, that will end up making us an even better society.
Thank you.
You're welcome.